Alaska Public Media's fall drive is well underway, and your support has been incredible. I'm Kristen Hall, the Director of Member Engagement. You can show your support today by clicking on that Make a Contribution button to your right. Thanks for choosing Alaska Public Media.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. In response to a dramatic rise in the number of people using, abusing, and actually dying from heroin throughout the United States, the state of Alaska in July 2015 released a report describing the health impacts of heroin use in Alaska. On this program, we're going to meet Jennifer Stuckey and Dr. Jay Caldwell of the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center in Anchorage and Dr. Jay Butler, who is director of the Division of Public Health. We're going to discuss heroin use, abuse, addiction, and the public health consequences of the use of heroin during the program. If you have questions, comments, experiences, anything you want to share with listeners, there's a couple of ways over the next hour only you're going to be able to do that, and that is by calling us locally at 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1. You have to spell that out. All is one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1 at alaskapublic.org. Jennifer Stuckey is the operations manager of the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center. She's been with the agency since 2003, so about 15 years. And Jay Caldwell is the medical director. He's been involved in that program since 1982 or so, he tells me. Welcome to all of you to Line 1. Thanks for taking the time.
Glad to
You're
be
welcome.
Here.
All right, Jennifer, let's do this. Let's start this program by talking about your organization, the Narcotic Treatment Center, and then we'll kind of talk a little bit about heroin and its use and abuse and try to drag in some of the public health consequences of this problem.
Okay, great. Well, I work for the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center. We have been in business since 1974. So we are a medication-assisted treatment program, and we use methadone to combat heroin addiction. And people come in, they self-refer to treatment. We have currently around 110 patients, and we are a nonprofit federal block grant recipient, which helps us subsidize the treatment and make it affordable for our patients.
Are there other treatment options in the city or within the state?
Yes, there is. There is the Anchorage Treatment Solutions, and they are a for-profit methadone clinic, and they are located off of Fireweed.
Okay.
And we do have a clinic, another nonprofit clinic in Fairbanks called Project Special Delivery. And they operate similar to the way we operate.
So I'm assuming that federal funding is done to other treatment centers similar to yourself in most of the major medical major cities in the United States.
Yes, throughout the United States.
Are they somehow interconnected for data and service and collecting information?
Yes, we are all connected. All methadone programs can exchange patients if they need to travel and things like that. So we are all very well connected.
Mm-hmm. So there's 110 patients now.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a typical number, or have numbers been growing?
Our numbers have been growing. We are funded to subsidize 100 treatment slots within the state. And so we're a little bit over that. But since I started, we started with 65 people when I started working there back in 2003. And we have slowly crept up because we've had increases of funding. And so right now we are funded for 100 treatment slots.
Well, Jay, let me do this. Let's bring you in a little bit. So the idea of this program, I think, came from the fact that we're beginning to be aware that fairly recently there's been a large increase in the use of heroin and some of the complications, and the state got involved and looked into it from what's happening in this state. Is that true?
Yes, and we should probably start by pointing out that we have two J's here, and the
That's
eye contact right. between you and I
Very
makes
good.
Me assume yeah. that question yeah. was posed yeah. towards me. nationally, there has been a dramatic increase in the number of heroin overdose hospitalizations as well as deaths, an increase of more than fourfold. And what we see in Alaska is basically a microcosm of what's going on nationally. Between 2008 and 2012, we saw a fourfold increase in the number of deaths. We saw a doubling in the number of hospitalizations for heroin overdose. Looking at the preliminary data for 2013-2014, it looks like we are continuing to see that increased number of overdose deaths. And at least the preliminary numbers for 2015 to date suggest that we may see actually a further bump up this year. So it's an emerging problem that is not just going away by any measure.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Caldwell is joining us by telephone again. He's the medical director of the treatment center. Jay, what is your... I mean, does your gestalt follow that we're going through some big sea change in the use of heroin?
Well, I should point out that I've been with the drug center since about 82, and it started in 74, so that the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center is not there because of the sudden increase in heroin use. It's been around for... what is that, 40 years. Now, what I've seen over these 30 plus years, is sort of waves of different kinds of addiction. So when I first started back in the 80s, there was a fair amount of heroin addiction. Then there came this sea change of oral opiates, oral plus IV, headlined by oxycodone. And that was partly a result of some problems with the drug manufacturers and physician misuse. Now that's sort of been curbed, and that's on the downswing. And then there has been this national uptick in terms of heroin use and heroin abuse. And we may talk about why, but there certainly has been that change. So what I've noticed is it's been cyclical, and there have been other drugs of abuse. Also,
well, let's stick with heroin for a minute, and I'm sure listeners want to know everybody's opinion or what we know from just real hardcore facts about why we're seeing problems with addiction in general, as well as perhaps heroin. But I'd like to get some historical perspective on and some better understanding of what heroin is, how long it's been around, how addictive is it, why is it addictive? Can you fill in those blanks?
Sure. Well, opium poppies, the poppy seed, which if you kind of cut open a poppy seed, there's a sort of oozy, gooey, white, sap-like substance. That is what opium comes from. And opium is a product that contains multiple drugs that we call opiates. It includes morphine. And it includes, and morphine is ultimately changed into heroin by a couple of chemical processes, so that heroin is a semi-synthetic, semi-manufactured form of a natural opiate. Poppy seeds also, opium also contains codeine. Another opiate, and another opiate called thebaine, which is the substance that people make Suboxone from. So there are multiple opiates in the opium sap. Heroin is in a lab is relatively easy to make from the morphine that is in the poppy. That's what heroin is. It's a chemically modified form of morphine. And morphine probably being the single best pain reliever, analgesic, that we've ever had. And it's still the drug of choice in military combat situations because it is so effective and works so quickly, albeit there is a risk of tolerance and whatnot that leads to addiction. So having said that, then the reason that heroin is so so readily addict somebody, and we ultimately should talk about that word addiction, because it's used in the popular vernacular in a different way than we use it in the substance abuse treatment community. But it's so quickly leads to dependence, tolerance, addiction, because it has an extremely short half-life. It has a very quick onset. Somebody takes in heroin in one of many different forms, and there will be an almost immediate response, I mean, within seconds to minutes. And then heroin in the body goes through a series of chemical changes that ultimately leads to sort of its washout in several hours, at which point the person who's using it needs to use it again because it's gone. And so people, when I interview people who are we take into our program, most of our new intakes use heroin 4 to 6 times a day, and they'd use it more if they could get more of it. So you use it over and over and over again for the quick hit and then the quick recovery, and then you need more of it. That's what leads to tolerance and dependence and the cycle that leads to why heroin is so addictive.
All right.
It's not like those old movie things, though, where you hold somebody down and you give them one shot of heroin and they're addicted for life. Right. It's not quite like that. But it is certainly highly addictive for the reason I just mentioned.
All right. Well, let's describe addiction. And you also have used the word tolerance a couple of times, and I think that's important to define as well.
Well, tolerance means that if you take a certain amount of heroin, a tenth of a gram, let's say, and you use that for a period of time, and everybody's going to be different, but you use it for a period of time, and you get a certain response, whatever that response is, whether it's a euphoria, whether you're chilled out, whatever it is you're shooting for, you use that on multiple occasions, you're going to need to use more than one-tenth of a gram to get that effect. Your body begins to tolerate it, which is, you know, true for almost anything. Your body does that for anything. You can expose yourself to loud sounds, and after a while you don't notice it anymore, and you need louder sounds to get that stimulation. So that's a normal body response to any physiological stimulus. And that's what tolerance is. So you need more and more heroin to produce the same effect. At the same time, you are chemically dependent on it, because you then begin to get withdrawal symptoms if you're not using it over and over again. And withdrawal symptoms are extremely unpleasant, it would seem. And therefore, you become dependent on the drug to maintain you at a level where you're not going through repeated withdrawal. So there's tolerance to the drug. Then you become chemically dependent on the drug. It's as if it's in your system all the time. That's what leads to this situation. Then what we call it, that's what people call addiction, that situation. What we call addiction is a situation in which there is some form of maladaptive behavior, usually around trying to get more drug. So it can be criminal behavior. It can be some kind of social misadventures. It leads to increasing use of family expenditures to obtain the drug. Maybe Jennifer and Jay can talk about the costs, although costs are sort of hard to pin down, because nobody really goes right onto the street and pays the price tag for morphine, for heroin. You get it in a variety of ways. But it does eat into your finances, obviously. That's what addiction is, when your behaviors become so maladaptive that you simply can't function. And so that applies to alcohol, which is pretty devastating addiction as well.
All right, so there is a physiological dependence on preventing the withdrawal symptoms, is what I'm hearing you say, and we might use the word addiction for that. But for you and Jennifer, it sounds like addiction is when this need to get this effect, it becomes socially driving your life, so to speak. I mean, you're going to do whatever it takes to get that. And so there are two ways the word is used, at least two ways.
Yeah, that's fair to say. And for instance, in some European countries, the United Kingdom in particular, heroin has even been used to treat heroin addiction. Because after all, the main point is, we generally think, is something called harm reduction. So you're not going out and beating people up. You're not going out and having robbing banks. You're not taking food from your family. That's harm reduction. So there's even a strategy, for instance, in the United Kingdom, to simply provide people heroin on a regular basis, and at the same time provide a lot of counseling and social services so that they can begin to get their life straight. We use methadone for other reasons, but you can use heroin to treat heroin addiction, because the problem with heroin addiction is the contaminants that come in the heroin that people buy on the street. If you didn't have contaminants in the street, there wouldn't be a whole host of additional health problems, infections and things like that that come about. People wouldn't be overdosing. Often overdoses are a reaction or come about because people don't get the amount of heroin that they think they're getting. They're used to buying heroin that's been cut in a certain way, sort of a certain amount of contaminants and put in, sugar, whatever it's cut with, and suddenly they get heroin that isn't diluted, and they take the same amount, and lo and behold, they get respiratory depression and they're dead. So if you can get rid of all those things in the United Kingdom, it can be used actually as a form of treatment. Mm-hmm. That's very important, because tolerance and dependence in themselves are not necessarily death sentences. It's the addiction behavior that leads to the harm and the death sentences.
Dr. Caldwell, do you want to, Dr. Butler, do you want to say something?
Well, I was just going to add to what Dr. Caldwell had pointed out in terms of the role of tolerance and how that relates to one of the puzzling factors in the epidemiology. We've seen an increase in heroin use, but the increase in heroin overdoses is actually disproportionately greater. And I'm sure we could spend the rest of the show speculating on why that is, but I think there's two reasons that are worth touching on. One is this issue of tolerance, and that if someone has been away from the opioid long enough, they've lost the tolerance. And let's say someone's coming out of incarceration and immediately goes back to using the dosages they used earlier, they're at a higher risk of an overdose from that same milliequivalent dosage. The other point is,
so that if they get something that's been adulterated or the strength is much higher than expected, it could cause much more damage or effect than they'd expect.
And that may lead into the second factor, is the purity of what's available now is much higher than in the past, particularly in the western part of the United States. Previously, we primarily saw black tar heroin, which was not very refined. It's a gooey, black, dark brown substance. I'm told it has kind of a vinegary smell, and it's not as pure as some of the powdered forms that are much more available now than in the past. So the concentration of what's available may be much greater also. And of course, none of these come with a package insert describing exactly how many milligrams of heroin you're getting or what the morphine equivalent is.
Mm-hmm. Or what else?
This is Dr. Caldwell. Just to comment on that last point, black tar heroin is less powerful because the way it's been produced, without getting into the chemistry of it, that when you take the opium and the morphine and the opium and refine it and produce, you add a couple of chemicals to the molecule, and you get heroin, which in its clear form is a very white, refined powder, granular powder. Black tar, however, is created in labs in which that chemical process is not carried out completely, so that the heroin that's produced is less effective, so to speak, so that when you and then that's further cut, as Dr. Butler just pointed out, but you have a less effective heroin, so to speak. So if somebody is taking black tar heroin and suddenly they're given relatively clean white powdered heroin, they're getting a much, much higher dose, and bad things happen real quickly then.
Jennifer, I wanted you're dealing with people daily, like Dr. Caldwell is. What is their understanding of their problem and how they got to it, and do they understand these differences and potential risks associated with using it? But the need for it kind of overwhelms that logic.
Yes, they are very well educated and well versed on heroin addiction and what happens. One thing we do, and I think other treatment providers could also do, and Department of Corrections, is part of my education to the patient prior to services, during services, after services, if they're being discharged, is don't go and fix that same shot that you did prior to coming into treatment, because your tolerance is much lower. And you will overdose. And don't get out of jail. If our patients do end up in jail, do not get out of jail and just go back to using the same amount of heroin. And it's something that I think us as treatment providers and people in Department of Corrections need to provide that education to the patient, because that isn't something that they're thinking of. They're thinking of, I need some drugs. I need some heroin. My brain is just is overwhelmed with heroin. And so We need to do that as treatment providers, but my patients are very well versed in heroin and addiction and what happens, and it seems the last probably 5 years people have just, we don't see a lot of pill use, I don't see a lot of opiates, and it is starting in high school, they started smoking heroin with their friends, or it's really scary that we have such a young population right now that are using heroin, but they are very well versed in the game.
Where do they, so you started to answer the question somewhat, is where does the exposure come from? We've talked on the program about the misuse and overuse and of narcotics for pain in this program, and how the medical community has a role to play. Where do most of the patients you're dealing with, I guess, how do they get into it? What's the common story, if there is one, about how this starts for them?
Well, because we are dealing with a much younger population now, I think our 19 to 25-year-olds are coming into treatment, which is something new to us. They are starting in high school, so it's readily available. It's on the street. Kids are obtaining heroin, and they're using it as a recreational drug in high school. And I'll have a lot of patients come in and say, you know, I used to smoke heroin in the parking lot at lunch, and I didn't think that I would become, you know, be injecting drugs at 19 and be in a methadone clinic at 22. So that is where it's just so available on the street that kids are starting to experiment with it.
How do they get to you? How do they come to the realization they've got a problem? Somebody else somehow gets them to understand the situation?
It's self-referral. They call us, and and they all have friends. The heroin addiction culture is very small in Anchorage, so that everybody seems to know each other from some form of dealings with in the past. And it is a lot of self-referral. 99% is self-referral, so they know to call.
And quite a few people come from within the same family social unit, so that generally we have a fair number of husbands and wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, parents, children, grandparents, parents, children, believe it or not. So there's that social family network as well.
All right. Since you brought it up, why would it be within a family? Why would it be persistently a problem within a family unit?
Well, Jennifer or I can both talk about that. The use of these kinds of drugs is a social affair. And when Jennifer was talking about kids smoking in the parking lot, you get into one another kind of, what do you want to call these drugs, euphoric drugs, primarily through friends and contacts. I mean, rare is the person who just on some sunny Wednesday morning thinks, I think I'm going to go find some drug that makes me feel better. They're almost everybody is in a social network that is sort of shifted toward that kind of mindset about how to gain pleasure. And this whole issue about is marijuana a gateway drug, you know, marijuana is not a gateway drug, but marijuana culture is certainly a gateway culture. And so in a family situation, you've got the same thing. If children have grown up in a family in which their parents or one or both of their parents are off in the bathroom for extended periods of time, although parents will almost always say, no, my 14-year-old doesn't know what I'm doing, or my 10-year-old, of course they don't. We keep it private. That's not true. Kids always know what their parents are doing. And so that's sort of the mindset of how to solve problems, how to gain pleasure. That's what the children are also going to do, and then they're going to gravitate in social situations to other kids who've grown up in that same kind of social milieu. And that's why families tend to do it together. Not together. That's why families tend to pass it on down from one generation to another.
All right. We need to take a break. We're almost halfway through. Things are moving pretty quickly. I did not want to give out our phone number again because I wanted to get some of this basic information down. But I will do that now. I remind listeners, we're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and then we'll continue our conversation on heroin use in Alaska with Jennifer Stuckey, Dr. Jay Caldwell, who's joining us by telephone, and Dr. Jay Butler, who's in the studio with me. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection, originating from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's program is about heroin use and abuse in Alaska. There's been a dramatic rise in the number of people using, abusing, and even dying from heroin throughout the United States, and the state of Alaska has recently looked into the program specifically in Alaska. We've intermittently been talking about some of those facts. That's called the epidemiology, but we're also trying to understand heroin abuse, its origins, and we need to talk a little bit about treatment options. Our guests are Jennifer Stuckey. She's kind of the operations manager of the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center here in Anchorage, and Dr. Jay Caldwell, who's on a line for on the telephone from Tucson. He is the medical director of the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center, and as I said earlier, Dr. Jay Butler is the director of the Division of Public Health, and he is in the studio. If you've got questions or comments, our email is line1@alaskapublic.org, our local number 550 8433, our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on Monday evening, it's a taped rebroadcast, and we will not be able to answer your questions. However, you can always go to alaskapublic.org, get the Line 1 archives, and listen to the program or refer someone to listen to the program again. Dr. Caldwell, let's back up 1 second. I am thinking, if I was listening to this program, that I might have questions about how fast and to what degree people might become addicted to heroin. I'm thinking people say, gosh, if I get that drug one time for the rest of my life, I might be addictive. Could you put some perspective on how that happens, how long it happens? Is it guaranteed to happen and so forth?
Well, that one shot, getting addicted, that's the old movie trope. I don't think I know the answer to that question. Everybody is quite different in terms of how they metabolize a drug. Everybody is quite different in terms of the components of their personality and their social and their family life that drive them into this kind of behavior. People have different health situations so that they're better or less able to metabolize the drug. It's hard to say. It is rare for somebody to simply drop in and start using heroin. It's a process, and they've started out doing other things, and whether it's marijuana, whether it's prescription opiates that they took out of the drug cabinet in their parents' bathroom. Rarely is the person going to get directly into heroin. And maybe Jennifer has a better sense for that than I do in terms of nailing the patients down to that. So I almost hate to try to answer that question. And you're like asking me in an isolated, pure situation. If you just start using heroin and you're a perfectly wonderful, clean person before that moment, when do you become tolerant and dependent and addicted to it? I don't think I know the answer. Probably weeks, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's the question we really want to ask, because it's a culture that evolves, and that's the important thing.
Okay. All right, Jennifer.
But Jennifer, maybe you should get her to say something about that.
Any comments, Jennifer?
No, I agree. It just depends on the person and where they're at in life. And,
all right. Mm-hmm. We have a number of some calls coming in. Before I take the calls, there's a couple things I want to make sure we discuss, and one is related to the other health issues related to heroin use. And Dr. Caldwell here, when they were looking at those things in the state, he can definitely fill us in on that. So let's start with that question: is what are the health implications other than the obvious addiction problem? Yeah, Dr. Butler.
Okay. Well, of course, my background is in infectious diseases, and how I first learned about black tar heroin was from cases of necrotizing fasciitis that were caused by injection of black tar heroin. Not only intravenously, but also skin popping, putting it under the skin, or muscling, at least that's what it used to be called, where you do an intramuscular injection. And these were, at times, very serious life-threatening infections. There's also been clusters of botulism associated with use of black tar heroin. Endocarditis is common. Injection through usually what's unsterilized skin can lead to bloodstream infections. The bacteria can set up on the heart valves and cause another life-threatening infection. And probably the most common thing is just cellulitis, because of the needles going through the skin provide an introductory route for bacteria to set up shop. Bloodborne pathogens, of course, are a big deal. It's estimated that about 60% of all new hepatitis C virus infections are caused by self-injection drug use. This is sort of a follow-on to our show last December on that topic. And I think we really have to discuss the current situation in southern Indiana, small town Austin, roughly the size of Dutch Harbor. Last December, they recognized three new cases of HIV, the AIDS virus, in pregnant women. This was a town that had historically only had about no more than three cases of HIV a year. In the follow-up to those cases, it was found that all three were self-injecting Opana, which is a prescription form of oxymorphone. In follow-up of people that they had shared needles and syringes with, eight more cases were identified. The investigation went on, and there's now been 181 cases of HIV infection identified in that one small town associated with intravenous drug use, mostly of prescription opioids, but some cases due to heroin as well. On top of that, almost 300 cases of hepatitis C virus. And one of the things I find a little frightening is when you look back at some of the data in Indiana, there was an increase in hepatitis C virus that occurred over the past couple of years. So there was some indication of increased self-injection drug use. And that's really occurring nationally. Every state, including Alaska, is seeing some increase in hepatitis C virus infection among younger people, which really goes against the old school or standing epidemiology of hepatitis C, that it's a disease primarily of baby boomers who either experimented with self-injection drug use or who had received blood transfusions before the blood supply was screened for hepatitis C. So that is definitely a very important added layer to the whole story with heroin, in addition to the tragedy of addiction.
And I just want to make sure everybody understands the problem there is the non-sterile use of intravenous medications or intramuscular or into the skin and so forth. People are sharing needles. They get contaminated from themselves. That next person uses the same needle, and they just high risk of spreading themselves, which gets into this giving people sterile needles is one way to stop that. And not only is there that risk to individuals who are using these non-sterile equipment, there's a huge societal cost to this. So the cost to treating hepatitis C and HIV, because people say, well, why do we give people clean needles? And can you just did you look into the costs of these complications as well as the addiction?
Yes, and in fact, there's an ongoing analysis of what it's going to cost in Indiana. Uh-huh. Now, they have liberalized their drug paraphernalia laws, but I think one of the drivers in that epidemic was they had very strict drug paraphernalia laws that actually made it a felony punishable by up to 3 years in prison if you were providing clean needles and syringes to someone who was addicted to any medication. There have been a number of studies looking at the cost effectiveness of needle and syringe service programs or exchange programs, and they are very favorable when you look at it. And it's not surprising given what it costs to treat hepatitis C, as we were talking about on a previous show. The good news is we can cure hepatitis C. The bad news, it generally costs about $100,000 to do that. HIV is not curable. The good news is people oftentimes live 30, 40, probably it won't be long until we have 50 years after a diagnosis is made. But it's a lifelong disease, and it's not cheap to treat. There's lots of concern that these programs are somehow enabling use. I think the experience as well as the data are not really supporting that. As Dr. Caldwell mentioned earlier, these are not necessarily drugs that people wake up in the morning and say they just want to go out and give this a try. It's oftentimes a process, and once you're addicted, it is very hard to stop, which is why we're having the discussions about treatment. And it's certainly not a cure-all, providing clean needles and syringes. It's risk reduction. It's not the best thing. The best thing would be able to make it possible for everyone to be treated appropriately and to manage their addiction so that they're not self-injecting. What's available, though, is to be able to reduce the health risks due to self-injection by mechanisms like this. And it's probably worth pointing out that currently there is a ban on use of federal funds to support needle and syringe service programs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I won't go there yet. But it's the natural tendency then to move towards real quickly treatment, and we ought to try to have time for prevention. And I'll keep asking the people that have called in to hang on. We'll try to get to them. Jay Caldwell, can you tell us what is the best practice evidentially that we can legally use in the United States? And what that's leading me to is what is our experiences compared to other countries in the world and their success rate and how they might look at it differently than we do?
Well, since the 1960s, it's been demonstrated by some pioneers back on the East Coast, Maryland and whatnot, Mary Jane Creek and Tom Nyswander, established that if you use a different opiate that had different properties, particularly the property was that it's a long-acting opiate in the sense that whereas heroin, the half-life is within minutes and its metabolites allow it to remain in the system for several hours. If you use a drug in which the half-life was around 24 hours, meaning a half-life is that if you take a certain dose, that after 24 hours, half of it will still be around. If you did that, you could then in a treatment program administer that drug and at the same time provide a host of psychological and social and other interventional services. You could then get people off, away from, out of the heroin culture, and that drug is methadone. And so the best practices these days in the United States, we don't use morphine, we don't use heroin to treat heroin addiction, as in the United Kingdom, we use methadone, and it is extremely effective. It is extremely effective in terms of reducing harm that Dr. Butler was just talking about. It's extremely effective in terms of getting people's social structure reestablished. And it is clean and simple, and it works. And the side effects are beyond few. It is a remarkably safe drug. It is so safe, in fact, that it is absolutely the drug of choice in a woman who is pregnant and is addicted to one or another opiates, whether it's an oral opiate or an injectable opiate. The idea is to put the mother also on methadone. And although the baby will have methadone when it's born, the baby can be sort of detoxed from that relatively easier and certainly far more safely than if the mother is coming in on heroin. So the best practice is simply to be involved in an established methadone clinic that is its actions are controlled by the federal government, something called SAMHSA, which I think stands for Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. I think I have that right.
Yep, you do.
Those programs there are all sorts of guidelines and regulations and clinic checkups by one or another arm of that program, and it works. It works for those people who are committed to having it work and to get themselves off of the street, so to speak.
All right. What I'd like to do is I'm going to go ahead and take two questions that we have that people have called in. Let's take Thomas first. Thomas, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I noted on national news that a police department on the East Coast, they came up with, if you want treatment, I know treatment's not available, but you come to us, your police department, and we're here to help you, not to arrest you, and they have volunteers working on this, so it's not really They started with a $5,000. They don't have money for it. So they started with $5,000 and volunteers. They want you just to come in to the police department and say, I've got a problem, and he will find you a place for treatment right there on the spot. And I'm thinking that the jail is full of people there that because of drug problems. And they could just turn one wing of the, you know, B mod or whatever, into the drug treatment mod, where they bring people in there and they give them the treatment that they need, and they see to help them to get a job.
Right.
That you were asking the question earlier, does the first hit guarantee that they're hooked? And I just wanted to say that it's a little different, but I accidentally took a puff of crack and the first time, and right there on the spot, I knew what it felt like to want to run down to the corner Quickie Mart and kill the cashier for $20 so I could get some more. I think a lot of that is like that. Anyway, that's something that I think people with a problem that should be able to walk into a place. I got a problem. The dealer, here's my dealer. Keeps me going. I want treatment. Get the dealer off the street and give me treatment. And work it on both angles, starting at that point. Have addicts come in and say, I want help. Help me get well and help me get rid of my dealer. And then you're attacking both sides of the problem at the same time.
All right. Thanks for your call. It's a good comment, Thomas. Jennifer, what's your comments on that idea?
Well, I think that's a good idea. I would love for this state, I would love for patients to be able to walk in and say, I need help right now. It would be so much more cost effective to treat people right when they need help than to have them sitting on waiting lists or things like that. It's much cheaper to treat them at that point. When you think of somebody that's on the street using drugs, it's not just the person that's being affected, it's their children. So now you have OCS and you may have foster children or, you know, foster placement at some point. That's really expensive. They do get sick and they end up in the hospital, and Medicaid pays huge bills for abscesses and for blood infections and for things like that. Mm-hmm. So addressing treatment, when somebody needs treatment, addressing it right there would save this state a lot of money.
Another big cost that I'm aware of is that when someone gets incarcerated or gets involved, that there's a big cost to foster care. There's a huge increase in the number of kids in foster care and the cost, both absolute costs and then the social costs of that. Here's another question that came in by email. Why do people move from heroin to something else instead of sticking with morphine and opiate pills? Dr. Caldwell, do you have any answer for that one?
I think you need to restate that. Why do people move from heroin?
Move to heroin instead of sticking with morphine or opiate pills.
My hunch is that the reason that people change their drugs is availability. How any particular individual gets their drugs is related to, again, their social services, their social circles, the availability of the drug in terms of the pipeline into Alaska. We certainly don't grow any poppies to speak of up here. So I think it has a lot. That has a lot to do with it. And I had mentioned earlier that people are always wondering, well, how much is this stuff, how much does a gram of heroin cost? And it's interesting that, people have all sorts of little clever things, 50 nifties, how much do you have to pay for that amount of heroin. But almost no one really buys heroin, well, not almost no one, but many people buy heroin through a system in which they become middlemen themselves. And so you buy a large supply of heroin, and then you sell that to your friends, and so it doesn't cost as much. The cost of heroin varies depending on your social circles, and your choice of drug is going to depend on what's available within your circles. The most common response is, well, where do you, when I ask the question, where do you get your name the drug? And the answer is, well, you know, I got friends, I got some connections that, you know, so that's, I think that's the simple answer, is that it's your own social circle that determines what you're going to use.
A parallel question that I have an email for, which I think we've kind of addressed on, but I want to make sure that people think we're trying to answer as many questions as we can, is how much of this is email, how much of the increase in illegal drug use is a result of doctors refusing to refill prescriptions for chronic pain sufferers? So this is a little bit of opposite of the way things were. Physicians clearly were perhaps doing too much. We still think that there's some concerns about the overuse, but this question is, now are people getting into illegal drugs because they can't get the pain relievers that they want? How much is that a problem, do you think? Anybody that wants to answer that one for us?
I'll take an initial crack at that. I think it's a factor, and I think one of the concerning practices that I do hear about is that when providers review their prescription drug monitoring database and they identify a problem, rather than intervening and counseling and referring that patient ideally to treatment services, they just get fired from the practice. And I think that is a major problem, because if we are talking about an addiction, patients then are left with some limited options. One is to start doctor shopping to find a provider who will provide the medications, or to get what's on the street. The additional component of the perfect storm, if you will, is that even though good hard data are hard to come by, as Dr. Caldwell was alluding to, it's pretty well agreed that the price of heroin is much, much less than it was before, that there is an abundance of high-grade heroin that's coming in mostly from Mexico now, which is a little bit of a shift from what it was 20 years ago, when the sources were more often further down in South America. Someone's even used the term farm to arm, because it's using some very basic agribusiness practices, as well as building customer bases, and it's made the drug very commonly prevalent. And we're seeing in some of the epidemiology, the biggest increases now are not in the inner cities, where heroin has been a challenge for a number of years, but in suburban and rural areas, primarily in white people. And this is a different economic model than what it was before, about 10 years ago.
It seems to me, I'm looking at another email that came in, as someone who says they work in obstetrics, and that women who are maybe using these kinds of medications are not coming to the hospital, they don't want to have the fear of being drug tested. And I'm thinking about the gentleman who called earlier and said, you know, we need to make it more easier and less difficult or culturally unacceptable to come in with a problem. We've got it stigmatized to the point where people don't want to come in for treatment. So it's almost like there's a huge cultural change that has to happen in the country to begin to address some of the treatment options. This is as you just said earlier, Dr. Caldwell, it's much more, addiction is much more of a social or a cultural kind of problem than it is necessarily a physical problem, which is another way we use the term. So when we don't understand the two ways the terms are used, it's somewhat making it difficult for our society to come to grips with the appropriate treatment.
That's true. And Jennifer is still on the line.
Yep.
It's worth having her comment on the program that she's worked so hard to set up with Alaska Regional in terms of pregnant women.
Mm-hmm. With pregnant women too, they could call me today, and I will get them into services as soon as possible. As soon as I can get them to come into the clinic, we'll get them treated. They don't wait for anything. We want them to be able to go to possibly the Office of Children's Services and say, I'm in treatment now, and you're going to need to monitor me, but I am going to be in treatment. And we have providers that we work with in the community that do help us with our pregnant women, that are very understanding and that have let us come in and talk about addiction and train them on methadone and things like that. We work with Alaska Regional and the NEST program, and they have a very nice little unit for babies that are in neonatal abstinence withdrawal. And they help the mom and the baby. The mom is right there the whole time with the baby. They treat the mother with the same dignity and respect that they would any other pregnant woman. And so we work really hard on those resources to keep mom and baby and everybody informed, and to keep mom motivated and doing what she needs to do in treatment to have that baby and take that baby home at the end.
Mm-hmm. Other comments? We're in our last couple of minutes. We haven't even approached the prevention aspect, which is always far, far cheaper than the treatment aspect. We kind of talked about it a little earlier. We're in our last, really, just 3 minutes. Dr. Caldwell, can I ask you to give me your ideas about prevention in a short order, and then we'll have to say thanks?
I think you're going to have to just say thanks. I'm not sure that I have much of a hook on how to prevent this. I mean, opiate addiction has been an issue for 300 years. Mm-hmm. I don't have any solution, I'm afraid. Although the fact is that because so much of the addiction problem is a social, family construct, that somehow or other penalties are not going to prevent the problem. There has to be some proactive thing to get families and social groups to embrace some other form of pleasure.
In pediatrics, I'm going to bring this up in the last couple of minutes, as I'm a pediatrician. There's a big movement afoot to recognize that the first 1,000 days of life are critical in how kids will be successful the rest of their life. And it's quickly, it's like your brain is very good at learning. You can learn how to ride a bike, but you can't tell me how to unlearn it. And particularly the very first 1,000 days, if kids are around a lot of trauma, if they see a lot of abuse, if they see drug abuse and so forth, then it almost... You know, it puts into their brain, this is a way things maybe should be. It may increase the likelihood of drug abuse. We know those first 1,000 days are pretty good at predicting how long people are going to live, what kinds of experiences they're going to have, and so forth. Does that make sense to you guys that are involved in heroin abuse?
Absolutely.
It sure does. It reminds me, if we go back to the Line 1 Archives Greatest Hits, when Gabor Maté from Vancouver was
That's
on,
true.
He talked about three ingredients to an addiction, a susceptible person, a substance with addictive potential, and stress. And stress may be related to adverse childhood events. It also is an important part of treatment. I think, as our caller earlier pointed out, when someone who has been incarcerated comes out and incarcerated for addiction, a job would be an important part of how to manage stress. Mm-hmm. But absent that kind of training and treatment of the addiction, what's left is to go back to the lifestyle that initially put them behind bars.
All right. Well, we are just about done. Dr. Caldwell, thanks very much for taking the time and joining us from Tucson, and we appreciate the time.
Well, you're very welcome.
Jay Caldwell and Jay Butler, thanks very much for your time as well. And Jennifer Stuckey, thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Lots of good information. I think it's worth listening to again. My thanks to those guests. If you want to continue the discussion on heroin use in Alaska, you can join KSK on Facebook. You can find that website at alaskapublic.org. There's a new standard, or the standard technology for helping diagnose seizures is the EEG. Now we can also add real-time video to help make those diagnoses. Next week we're going to talk about video EEGs. So why don't join me next week at 2 p.m. Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer of Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron engineered today's show. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.